Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Aaron Brown. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is how many people can government govern, the human scale of political order, or why democracy doesn't work, and how freedom and prosperity flourish without the violence of government. I first want to welcome our special guest, Dr. Donald Livingston. Hello, Dr. Livingston.
Hello, Aaron.
It's great to have you here. Dr. Livingston is the founder of the Abbeville Institute and is the editor of the book on which this interview is based, Rethinking the American Union for the 21st Century. If you haven't gotten it, I highly recommend you pick up a copy. It's on Amazon, and it's an excellent book. You wrote that this book, Dr. Livingston, it's not a book full of policy prescriptions. Rather, it's a simple and open-ended invitation to rethink the assumptions that have led us to believe that size and scale do not matter in political things. Could you take a second to comment on that?
Yes. Well, I think size and scale has been ignored by major political philosophers in the West and also by political scientists. Usually what they talk about are rights and the nature of authority and the ideals of government and forms of government and on. And they don't ask the question, or whatever form you might prefer, or whatever liberty is, or whatever rights are, at what scale can human beings be associated to enjoy these things? A committee, for example, is a wonderful thing, but if you had a committee of, say, 2,000 people, it just wouldn't function. You wouldn't have a chance to speak, or if you did, you could only utter a soundbite. So the committee would fail, not because the people in it weren't virtuous or you know, enthusiastic and competent, but simply because it's too big. The same with a jury. A jury works because there are 12 people in it. They have to have unanimous consent. But if you expand it to 120, it wouldn't function as a jury. You'd have to go by majority vote, and if you did that, you wouldn't have a jury. So everything in human life is this way. A charming English cottage is all very well, but if you tried to make it four times its size, even if perfectly proportioned, you would end up with a monstrosity. And the same is true with political order.
I really, you know, in Austrian economics, and we talk about reality economics on Radio Free Market, and we often use these kind of these isolated situations where we look at, you know, the guy alone on the island, and I thought that was a very that was just a very helpful mental exercise for me to kind of get ready to read the book with the jury example. I thought that was really, because of course, most people will read that and say, of course a jury can function with 120 people. Of course, you know, 12 people at least seems manageable, even though at times I'm sure it doesn't seem manageable. But then you talk about government and you say, yeah, of course Washington D.C. should be directing everything from the lives of 300 million people. And most people won't question that, but you know, you use little examples like that, like the jury going to 120 people. People will have to concede, yes, of course, this is ridiculous. You wrote about a man in your introduction named George Kennan, who was instrumental in drafting America's policy towards the Soviet Union, and he wrote on what he described as the hubris of inordinate size, which is the tendency to think that if a nation is physically big in the sense of landmass, that its role in world affairs should be equally as big. And I thought this was fascinating. Could you comment on this insight?
On George Kennan?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, as you say, he's known as a his career was in foreign policy and analysis. He was known as a moderate, a realist. He crafted the containment policy for the Soviet Union. It's called the Long Telegram that he sent from Moscow. It's about 27 pages long. And near the end of his career at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton, he came to the view that the United States is simply too large for self-government. It's not too large for an empire, and this is something we need to remember. Empires are big. If you want to have an empire and a monarchy, you want something large. Even there's a limit. But America claims to be a republic, and we cannot escape that language. We are republican all the way down, in the classical sense of republic. And one of the things that tradition taught is that republics have to be small, because you cannot have self-government and the rule of law if the republic becomes too large. You end up with something like monarchy, and monarchs don't even pretend to give you self-government. The British monarchy, for example, describes its people as subjects, not citizens. I mean, they kind of are citizens now, but I mean, the tradition is they are tax-paying subjects, and they may have certain good things to come from monarchy, but they're not self-governing. So if Americans want to be self-governing, they do have to pay attention to the notion of size and scale, because Republican tradition for over 2,000 years argued that that was essential to self-government. Kennan came to the view that we're just too big. And he said the only solution then is to begin a public debate on how to downsize this monster that the United States has become. And many people who read his, he argued this in his autobiography titled Around the Cragged Hill. And he has a chapter called Dimensions. Many people will not really appreciate what he's saying because we're used to people saying government is too big, Washington is too big, but what they mean is that Washington shouldn't tax as much or spend as much or shouldn't regulate as much. That's not what Kennan's talking about. He's talking about that, but mainly he's saying that the only way for Washington not to be doing these things is to divide the Union into distinct territorial jurisdictions, and that is something most people don't think about. In other words, divide the Union. It's just too big. When a corporation becomes too large, it does something called downsizing. It divides.
Mm-hmm. And it's not heresy to talk about a corporation dividing. That's just kind of the common sense solution that the managers of that corporation see as a way of going forward.
Absolutely. And the Soviet Union, a huge artificial corporation, so to speak, became dysfunctional. And the states in the Soviet Union, over time, began to foot drag, interpose, nullify legislation or acts of Moscow. And finally, Lithuania got tired of nullifying, and they said, we'll just leave. And they seceded. And then one after another, 15 states peacefully seceded from the Soviet Union. The world did not come to an end. Mm-hmm. And many of those, some of those states doing quite well, Lithuania and Estonia.
Mm-hmm. And that essay about the Soviet Union was written by Yuri Maltsev, who has been on this show many times, and you can look up his our interviews with him in the RadioFreeMarket.com archives. Before, you know, when we talk about, much of the book focuses on, you know, political decentralization, and that kind of inevitably leads to a talk about nullification and secession, like you talk about with the Soviet Union. Sometimes we can't even get further than that with people because there has to be an understanding that of what the United States in particular was, that the states actually created the Union. We don't have time to go over all the incredible primary sources that Kent Masterson Brown identifies in his essay in the book, but it really was a very, I was fascinated reading his essay. He wrote that at first the preamble to the Constitution said we the people, and then it listed all of the states at the convention. Will you tell us that story? I thought it's an incredible story.
Well, yes, the all of the all 12 states were mentioned, because remember, this Constitution was drafted under the Articles of Confederation. So when they did anything, they said, we the people of the states of New Hampshire, and they went all the way down to Georgia, do so-and-so. By unanimous consent, the convention accepted that language, and so the thing was done, and it was given to a committee on style, headed by Gouverneur Morris, New York, and they found a problem, because Article 7, and people ought to read Article 7 of the Constitution, because it tells you who authorizes the Constitution. And what it says is that if 9 states ratify the Constitution, the Constitution will hold, quote, between the states so ratifying the same, end quote. So only 9 states are needed to ratify the Constitution. And if only 9 ratified, the other 4 would still be under the Articles, and they could stay under, or they could do whatever they wanted to do. In other words, the Articles are dissolved. And so it was realized that, maybe only 9 will ratify. And if 9 ratify, we cannot say the people of the states of New Hampshire, et cetera, have ratified it, because we don't know which states will ratify. So they used other language they had used before, we the people, and meaning the people of the several states. And that change was read out loud to the members line by line with the old language of we the people of the states, and no objection was raised. In other words, the committee said that these words mean the same. So when people say, preamble says, we the American people, and they mean the American people in the aggregate, that's a mass, that's not what the framers meant by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was just, it's kind of a slam dunk to show people that, yeah, okay, the states created the union, this should be apparent now to you, right? But it's also kind of, it seems like a big mistake, in my opinion, that they, wouldn't you agree that they kind of use this collectivist language, we the people, and people now have kind of forgotten that it used to be we the people of this state, this state, this state, this state, this state?
Yes, it's very important. Yes, they have forgotten it. One reason they've forgotten is they haven't been taught it, because there were those in America who did not want a federation. Hamilton didn't want a federation. Others didn't, but that's what they got. And that's why Hamilton called the Constitution a, quote, frail and worthless fabric, end quote, because it was not a nationalized, centralized state. It's just what he wanted. And it's interesting, in landmark decisions by John Marshall, McCulloch, and others of the decisions, and by Story, and by Webster, those jurists do not mention in any of their arguments, none of them do they mention Article 7. Mm-hmm. Article 7 says, Constitution is a compact, quote, between the states, not all the states, but between the states ratifying the same, mm-hmm. Whatever those states are. So voluntary compact between whatever states, it's a total of 9, ratified it. And it's really disingenuous for Marshall, Story, and Webster not to bring up Article 7 and explain why it's not a federation. Same with Lincoln, and this has been carried on ever since. And the Civil War made it worse, because there the language began to be, we began to use the language of the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. The French Revolution described the regime as, quote, a republic, one and indivisible, end quote. And we say that in the pledge, one, a republic indivisible. And that means there's no secession. That means there's no federation. That means the states are not really states. They're just counties in a big monster state.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good point to take a break on. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about Alexander Hamilton and the shenanigans that he pulled at the after and during the convention. So we will be back on Radio Free Market with Dr. Donald Livingston. I'm your host, Aaron Brown. We will be back in 1 minute. Stay with us. Hello, America and the world. We are back on Radio Free Market with Dr. Donald Livingston. And I wanted to ask you a question about annulment of a contract. In Kent Brown's essay, he gave an excellent history of Anglo-American law, with reference to contracts. And he wrote that there were several remedies to a problem when a contract was violated. The final one of which was what he called rescission, or the annulment of a contract. Can you talk about this time-honored concept?
Yes, in contract law, there's no such thing as a perpetual contract. It's always possible, for there to be an appeal to equity and a rescission of the compact. And especially with states that form a compact, the teaching in international law at the time, right on up until today, was that compacts between sovereign states having no precise term of duration are compacts at will. And since there's no authority above sovereign states in a compact, that's why they're sovereign, there's no authority above them, each state itself must determine what the grievance is and the remedy. Now, there's no other authority that can tell it what the grievance is and what the remedy is. And so, since Article 7 says that the Constitution is a compact between the states that are ratifying the same, it's up to the states to decide when their rights are insufferably violated. Or, even if they're not violated, if they simply want to leave and improve their condition. This is an important thing. States don't have to suffer tyranny to get out of a union. They just have to, if they want to improve their condition, that's a sufficient reason. Since it's a compact, it will. Now, they'll have to pay their share of a public debt or any other obligations that were incurred, but they can leave.
Yeah, Kent Brown, he put a quote in his essay. It said, it is a perpetual law that no human impositive law can be perpetual, and a clause in law which precludes the power of abrogation is void from the beginning. You know, and as I go through, the list of pro-freedom arguments from, on any issue, that the convincing thing to me that it doesn't take a legal degree, it doesn't take a state-sanctioned license, it just kind of takes a little bit of common sense. I mean, no one would ever say they had the right to kill their friend if their friend wanted to secede from their friendship. But all of a sudden we do it on a scale of 300 million people, and all of a sudden, you're crazy.
Yeah. No, it's a profoundly distorted way of thinking, and that's why we wrote this book. It's called Rethinking. We need to rethink some of the paradigms, and one of them is that a modern state is indivisible. See, this notion of indivisibility, we don't have time to really go into it, but it comes about in the 17th century, the notion that sovereignty is indivisible, the king's sovereignty is indivisible. When the kings are overthrown and we get republics as in the French Revolution, then the republic is indivisible. As I said, the French were the first to say that. Mm-hmm. And then after the Civil War, the American state is indivisible. Prior, no one would say it's indivisible. I mean, secession was a public policy option throughout the entire period from 1790 up to 1860. It's a paradigm that is losing its authority. I mean, the Soviet Union was indivisible. Its national anthem says it is indivisible, mm-hmm. unbreakable. Well, it came apart. Wasn't indivisible. Yugoslavia came apart. Norway seceded from Sweden in 1905. We forget that. But Singapore seceded from Malaysia in 1965, I think.
Mm-hmm. I guess instead of a neo-Confederate, they'll have to call people who are in favor of secession neo-Malaysians and neo-Sri Lankans, I guess, now.
Yes, I know. That's right. Well, that's another almost adolescent-type argument that when you talk about nullification and secession, people talk about slavery, which is preposterous. Mm-hmm. Any federal system, anywhere, the ancient world and right on up, has a common structure, namely their political units that pre-existed the Federation. So they don't need the Federation. They existed prior to the Federation. They joined the Federation for certain benefits, usually commerce and defense. And if that's the case, then there should be some form of corporate veto that the states have to bad central policies, the most extreme of which being just withdrawing. I like to point out to people who pull the neo-Confederate line that Canada has, the Canadian provinces can nullify federal law in the area of civil rights. And they can opt out. A province can opt out. So whatever the issue might be in civil rights, Manitoba could opt out. They have to reaffirm that every 5 years, but they have the right to nullify and beat to their own drum.
And no one's calling the Canadians neo-Confederates.
What?
And no one would ever call a Canadian neo-Confederate. That just wouldn't make sense.
No, and a Canadian province can secede. Canada, Quebec almost seceded in, I think it was 1995, by one vote. They stayed in. But the Supreme Court has ruled that there's a conditional right to secession of the Canadian provinces. So they talk about nullification secession almost every day. It's a healthy thing. If you don't have it, then there is no way to prevent the central government from sucking economic and political life out of the provinces.
And as you said, you know, the states were the people. I mean, we talk about states, but I mean, states are composed of people. People at the time were aware. They were taught that nullification, secession, these were bulwarks of liberty. And I read in Kent Brown's essay again. He said, you know, he pointed out Virginia, New York, Rhode Island. I might be missing one or two, but I took this quote from his essay. Virginia, New York, and Rhode Island, at least, they said, we're not going to enter this unless we have the right to get out. So,
yeah.
I mean, does it make sense that these three states would sign this document and become a part of this compact if they knew they were going into a system that they could never escape, no matter how that governed or, you know, abused its power and authority? That just doesn't make any sense.
No sense at all. The Constitution barely passed anyway. It's barely ratified. Had anyone told them what Lincoln would say later, that once you're in this union, you can't leave, there's no way it would have passed, period.
And you know, Dr. DiLorenzo, who we have multiple shows in our RadioFreeMarket.com archives. If this is the first time listening to the show, go to our archives. We have lots of shows from Dr. DiLorenzo, and he has an essay in your book, and he writes that Chief Justice, of New York, Robert Yates, he remarked that since the Constitution created a compact among free and independent states and not the creation of a national government, that it was proposed and seconded to erase the word national and substitute the words United States, to point out that United States, at its plural, that this is not a national government. But today we say United States as if it were one entity. Can you comment on how this kind of very simple term is overlooked and just misconstrued?
Well, it is because of the way all of our history after the Civil War has been written from a nationalist perspective. In fact, the American Historical Association was formed after the war in part to frame this nationalist story.
Really?
And the Sons of the American Revolution and a number of other organizations were formed to strengthen this nationalist story, including the Pledge of Allegiance that began in the late 19th century. It's an interesting story in itself. I won't go into it much, except to say it started as a private matter to try to get the kids and the public interested in the nation. Because after the war, Civil War, America started going back to its federal character, and the war enthusiasm and nationalism was dying, and the attempt to try to keep it warm, and this took a long time. Finally, the pledge caught on, but it's interesting that Congress did not approve it until 1940, and didn't approve the Star-Spangled Banner until 1937. So, most Americans think the Star Spangled Banner was sung about the time of Francis Scott Key, and the pledge has always been here. So it took a long time to hammer into Americans' minds that this is a nation, not a federation of states.
Mm-hmm. We're gonna take a short little break. We're gonna come back and we're going to talk about Alexander Hamilton, good old Alexander Hamilton. We will be back on Radio Free Market. I'm here with Dr. Donald Livingston. We're talking about this new book. It's called Rethinking the American Union for the 21st Century. We will be right back. Stay with us. Hello, America and the world. We are back on Radio Free Market with Dr. Donald Livingston. And Don, you told me something interesting over the break about how we think we have representation in the United States with our wonderful democracy, but we really don't.
Yeah. Well, as I said before, the Republican tradition for over 2,000 years held that republics had to be small. And most people don't realize what that means. If you look at that 2,000-year history, you'll be hard-pressed to find any republic that's over 200,000 people. I mean, they meant real small.
How interesting.
And that means ancient Athens had around 170,000 people, produced a world-class culture, Plato, Aristotle, so on. Florence, the leader of the Renaissance, Michelangelo, Da Vinci, Galileo, great architecture, and so on. So you don't need big states to produce world-class culture. Now, defense might be a problem sometimes, and you need to trade with other states, but you can do that through federation or just free trade. But politically, you don't need large states. All right, so here's America. It's going to be a Republican, and everybody in America knows this. And they've got this huge territory. And the question is, can they be Republican? And Richard Lee rises in the House of Burgesses in Virginia. Virginia had acquired the Northwest Territory from Britain. That would include Indiana, Ohio, Wisconsin, Illinois, parts of Michigan. It's a lot of territory, and they conquered it. And it belonged to Virginia, not to the Union. And Richard Lee said Virginia could not be a republic and have such territory. It would have to centralize power, and that would destroy its republicanism. So what he's saying is that republicanism would die in Virginia just by virtue of the size of the territory it commanded, and it had to get rid of it. Well, see, that shows you how they were thinking. And Jefferson thought Virginia was too big, and it should be divided into little ward republics like the Swiss cantons. Switzerland has 7 million people, and it's a little over half the size of South Carolina. It has 26, actually, little states. Mm-hmm. Well, how did Americans solve this problem? Through secession. Although the territory was huge, the human scale of government was very small. Only 5% of people lived in urban areas, and the largest was Philadelphia with only 30,000 people. Now try to imagine that. That's the world of the founders. Mm-hmm. 30,000 people is the biggest city. And New York did not become the size of ancient Athens until 1830. Mm-hmm. So the framers, when they worked out their political ideas, they were in a world of a human scale smaller than ancient Greece. Territory was large, but the population wasn't. So, as the population filled up in a state, you had to have secession. So, Kentucky secedes from Virginia, Delaware secedes from Pennsylvania, Maine secedes from Massachusetts, Tennessee secedes from North Carolina. And this process was supposed to continue. That's the only way you can have self-government in America with this scale, is constant division in the direction of a more human scale, even down to Jefferson's little ward republics in the state of Virginia. Mm-hmm. And America was going that way. And when 11 American states seceded in 1860, they were just following out what Jefferson and others at the time thought would naturally happen on a continental scale.
Mm-hmm. And even
so, we stopped doing that. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. Go ahead with your thought.
We stopped doing that after the Civil War. Now let's look at the way we are now. We have 435 members in the House of Representatives. 435. And that figure is capped by law. that's one representative for every 750,000 people. Now, that's a meaningless ratio of representation of population. The founders discussed this, and Madison argued, he does this in the Federalist Papers and elsewhere, that the ratio should be 1 for 30,000, that the congressional the House district should not be over 30,000 people. Some thought it could be 50,000, some thought it would be 60,000. 60,000 was the highest anybody proposed. But let's take Madison's figure of 1 for 30,000 people in the House. That would give us 10,500 members today in the House of Representatives. 10,500. Well, most people would say that's too large for a lawmaking body.
Well, then maybe the government is too large. Most people wouldn't go to that logic.
Yeah, but does that mean that that Madison's Republican ratio of 1 for 30,000 is wrong? Or does it mean that the United States, as Karen has said, is just too big? It's suffering from bulimia, like a person that weighs 600 pounds. It's too big. Look at it another way. Let's suppose that our ratio of representation of population were in place in 1790. There would have been only 5 members in the House of Representatives for nearly 4 million people. Now, in anybody's criteria, 5 members for 4 million is not self-government. And none of the founders would have believed it. But we don't believe it. So, you see, we have a structural problem here. If 435 is about the right size for a lawmaking body in the House, if that's the right size, and if you look at congressional districts around the world, if you look at lawmaking bodies around the world, that's about the right size. They range from 200, the largest is around 600. Mm-hmm. 435 is about the right size. So let's not change that. Well, as population increases, we're going to lose, you know, the self-government will diminish. So when we get 435 million people, we'll have one representative for every million people. Well, this can't go on. You just can't keep adding people and not expanding the House. And it won't do to add another 100 people or something to the House. You're going to have to expand it to a real self-governing ratio like Madison's. And this means you're going to have 10,500, for example, in the House. And, you know, that's something people just haven't thought about.
Mm-hmm. We almost, as human beings, we almost we can't fathom these big numbers. It's almost these kind of big issues, because we think there's it's just you're not allowed to kind of think these things. But just like Joseph Story said in his work, Commentaries on the Constitution. This was in your book. He said, a single state would mean dissolution of the government and the end of the operation of the laws of the Union. And Thomas DeLorenzo kind of points out, I mean, does anyone really think seriously that if, let's say, California seceded from the United States, that, you know, the United States would cease to operate? I mean, is that I don't really think that claim can really be taken seriously. I mean, just like you said.
No, it's so absurd but it's said all the time by people, a lot of people. I mean, the United States, 11 states seceded in 1861 out of 34 states, and the poor, rump United States was so powerful that it formed the biggest army ever in modern times.
Exactly.
So it's just absurd. Well, another thing is, what is the Union? I mean, remember, Article 7 says you need only 9 states. So the United States, the Constitution requires only 9 states. Well, if 11 states seceded today, you know, you still have a large number of states. The Union exists with 9 states. The Union exists with 12 states. The Union exists with 24 states. The Union exists with 34 states. And you subtract 10 from the 34, you get 24. You still have the Union, you see?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that says the Union has to have a certain number of states. There's a minimum number, but there's no limit to the large number, and there's nothing in the Constitution at all that prevents division. Mm-hmm. Nothing. In fact, Article 7 implies it, because it already has division in it, 9 from 4. Mm-hmm. But there's another thing I want to point out about this scale, if I might, just a small point, but it's very important. We have around 315 million. I mean, it's not quite clear, but let's just say that, 315 million people, and a lawmaking majority of the House and Senate is only 269 people. That's all. For 315 million. Just let that soak in for a moment. That small number, that majority, can make war, it can run up a debt, et cetera, et cetera. But it's worse than that, because if House and Senate use a quorum, then jointly, the majority of both houses is only 135 people. can do this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So, but it's even worse than that, because most laws are not made by Congress. Most regulations come from the executive department, from the vast bloated bureaucracy under the control of one man. In fact, he can't even control it. So this Obamacare will be determined not by Congress, but by the Department of Health Education, you know, secretary, which has enormous discretion. And it's even worse than that, because most social policy is not made by the state legislatures, medical marijuana and all of those things, but by the Supreme Court. So, you know, we just don't have self-government in the United States. That is not a cynical statement. It is a factual statement. If you take the Republican tradition and look at what people have meant by self-government up to the French Revolution, then we don't have it.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked a little bit about the French Revolution here and there during this interview, but I wanted to ask you about, in Tom DeLorenzo's essay, he wrote that Joseph Story claimed that every part should pay obedience to the will of the whole. And, of course, the will of the whole is going to be defined by guys like Joseph Story. But Dr. DeLorenzo wrote that this idea of the will of the whole, the general will, came from Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Can you tell us a little bit about the philosophy of Rousseau?
Yes. Rousseau is a real contested figure. I mean, there are people that love him and people that hate him. He has a lot to answer for. There's a lot of craziness in Rousseau's philosophy, I think, education and a lot of other things. But I think he's also been misunderstood. Let me say what I think is good about Rousseau. He, in the social contract, there he lays out what he considers to be a republican form of government. But you know how large it is? 10,000 people. Mm-hmm. He has only 10,000 people in it. People ignore that. Again, they don't pay attention to size and scale. So his notion of the general will might make some sense if you have a population, a homogeneous population that small. There's a sense in which, you know, each part is for the whole and for the whole is each part. It's like a family.
It's like the Three Musketeers.
Each part of the family is for, what?
It's like the Three Musketeers, for all for one, one for all.
Yeah, that's right. Each part of the family is for the whole is for the part. But to have that, you need a homogeneous culture with a common tradition, probably a common religion, et cetera, et cetera. His Geneva, which he based it on, had around 26,000 people. So he's, again, in that ancient Republican tradition of small states. Most people don't realize that the Greek civilization that Republicanism was built or came from, they invented it. That civilization was unique in the history of the world, because there was no centralized government whatsoever. It was made up of 1,500 tiny republics, the largest of which was about 170,000, mm-hmm. the average size of which was 6,000. Think of that now, 1,500 republics creating they traded, they had a great culture. We still take inspiration from them. So when people tell me that you cannot have a civilization made up of small states, just not true. One of the most brilliant civilizations ever was made up of very tiny states. I'm not saying we can reproduce that, but there's no reason why humans can't do something like that. Mm-hmm. But Rousseau is absurd. If you map his social contract onto France with 50 or 60 million people, then we don't. This general will makes no sense whatsoever. It just becomes tyranny.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the for people like Joseph Story, the appropriate response to government tyranny is to go to, quote, proper tribunals constituted by the government, which, quote, appeal to the good sense of the people. Is this the great system that the Constitution embodies, that you go to the tyrannical government that oppresses you and ask them to change their minds?
No, it's absurd. Or take the way we have now, the out of scale, where we have one representative for every 750,000 people, and where the bureaucracies are making most of our laws, not even Congress. Okay, so we wait for next elections. We're wringing our hands, hoping the Supreme Court will affirm our fundamental rights in this Obamacare business. Mm-hmm. And that's not a free people.
No, it's not. And we're kind of on our last couple minutes, but I wanted to take the last, 8 or 9 minutes or so and talk about, the Constitution and American federalism. They're still with us, and they've been perverted for the last, few hundred years by, slick legal scholars and activist judges and tyrannical dictators. But, the Constitution is still here, and it kind of never left. Is this the most stable system we can hope for? Where would you like to see this go from here?
Well, I think we've inherited an incoherent constitutional tradition after Lincoln, because to oversimplify it perhaps, but I think it makes the point. The Constitution is a compact between states. That's what it is. That has never changed. None of the Reconstruction amendments changed that. Article 7 stands. It's a compact between the states. States have they have the right of nullification and secession any time they want to exercise it. Now, if they do exercise it, that will be a political act. The other state, you'll have to take account of what the other state's going to do. But that is a right of the states. Now, however, Lincoln and nationalists interpret the Constitution as a unitary state, one and indivisible. And the states function like counties. Lincoln actually called them counties. He said, and this is a quote, I have it, it's easy to remember. He asked, what is this peculiar sacredness of a state? If a state in one instance and a county in another have the same territory and population, wherein is the state superior to the county?
Oh, wow.
A man who could not tell the difference between an American state and a county, you would think, was not competent to be president. But that was Lincoln's view. And, okay, so what happens is, when you and I look at the Constitution, we, if we're honest, we cannot help but see a federated instrument. But when we look at what the Supreme Court and the national government talks about, then we see a unitary state like France. One and indivisible. Mm-hmm. You see the incoherence. I mean, it's like oil and water. Mm-hmm. You cannot read a federated document as that of a unitary state, and you cannot read a unitary state document as that of a federated state. Mm-hmm. See, what the French did is they did it right. They just destroyed the Constitution, the old Constitution. They wrote a new one and enforced it by the sword, and nobody in France denies that. They all know what the Constitution is. Whereas in America, Lincoln and the Republicans kept the founding Constitution, but interpreted it in a unitary state way, and that has left us with a deep, grinding incoherence. So I used to teach philosophy of law, and I have occasion to meet professors of law all over the country, and some of them will say the Constitution's dead. It's simply dead. It's not enforced. Others will say, oh, no, the Constitution is very much alive. The ones who say it's dead are reading it as Jefferson would read it, as you and I would read it. Mm-hmm. They don't see that it's being enforced. And the others who think it's alive are reading it as Lincoln would read it, because the central government, or mainly the Supreme Court and the central government, can define what it is, and they keep doing it. And so it's very much alive. Mm-hmm. So the first thing Americans need to do is realize we have this incoherence. And for those who I don't know what to say about it, except that that's the first beginning of wisdom. And then the second thing is, for those of us who believe it's a federation, is to begin a political process that acts as if it were, and to try to encourage the states to recall their civic virtue by interposing and protecting their citizens from unconstitutional acts of the central government.
Mm-hmm. You know, I lived in San Diego for a time. I went to college down there, and I woke up one day and read the newspaper, and I was just, my eyes almost popped out of my head. It was talking that there was an article written that La Jolla, which is a one of the more wealthy cities there, wanted to secede from the educational bureaucracy. They felt that they were improperly having to pay for other cities' schools. So they were talking about seceding. You know, looking at the 50 states that are, again, like you say, they're just kind of counties of the federal government. They're just enforcement arms of what the federal government decrees. Do you see that perhaps instead of the states, that maybe counties or smaller polities will start to take on this idea? Because it seems like the states are so corrupt that it must have to happen on a smaller scale.
Yes, the states are too big, too, as far as that goes. For example, if Texas were an independent country, it would have a GNP about equal to that of Russia. Mm-hmm. And Russia's a major player in the world. No. Think of that. And California has a larger GDP than Texas. So this baby is huge. This United States is vast. Yeah, the states are too big, too. Remember when we still, part of the Civil War, when we thought in federal terms, it was, secession was natural, healthy, and it happened a lot. As I mentioned, Delaware seceded from Pennsylvania, Kentucky from Virginia, and so on. These states divided. There was a movement in California in 1992, I think it was 22 counties in the north. Contiguous counties voted to secede from California and formed the 51st state.
Mm-hmm.
California didn't approve it, so it didn't go anywhere. Norman Mailer ran for New York, mayor of New York, on the platform of New York seceding and forming the 51st state. It would be divided into Swiss-like cantons, in his view. So we need to encourage talk of self-government secession on all levels, and I think you're right. The smaller places where we should start, that's doable, even if you just secede from educational system, secedes from the county system or something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
There was a movement, by the way, in Holland. I haven't kept up with it, but they have a problem in Belgium. They've got Dutch-speaking, French-speaking, and the Dutch-speaking people wanted to integrate their educational system with the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're still being politically in Belgium, but so there's no reason why people can't do that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that is going on.
Mm-hmm. And that is certainly encouraging. And this is, again, it's a wonderful book. It's called Rethinking the American Union for the 21st Century. I'm going to throw it up on our RadioFreeMarket.com homepage and also on our Facebook page. Thank you so much, Dr. Livingston. This was great. We'll have you on again, because we barely scratched the surface of your book. There is so much good material, and I'm sorry we couldn't cover all of it, but we'll have to have you on again.
Well, thank you, Aaron. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So thank you to Donald Livingston for being with us today. This is Aaron Brown on Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at RadioFreeMarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows. Or you can go to iTunes and download all of our shows again for free. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.